The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Denise Riley presiding. Now calling the case of Nichols versus Nichols, A20-0540.
And good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. You each will have 15 minutes for your arguments, and Mr. Westrick, you'll have 5 for rebuttal if you choose to use it. We are recording these hearings, so if you would please state your name at the beginning of your argument. And with that, appellant, are you ready to begin?
I am, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Westrick. I represent the appellant, Ms. Deborah Nichols. The first issue I want to address today is whether or not the clearly erroneous standard applies to initial findings when there's then a later motion for an amended findings. I think the language in Rule 52 is very clear. It does. Cases that have interpreted when a successor judge is involved in a Rule 52 motion, the clearly erroneous standard applies. And I really don't think there's much of a question in that the rules of civil procedure apply at all times to a motion for amended findings. And this is in the rules of civil procedure and govern the district court.
But Rule 52 point, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Judge Frisch.
Rule 52.02 specifically addresses amended findings and does not contain a requirement that in order for a judge to amend its findings, it must first determine that its previous findings were clearly erroneous. Is there any case law that supports the proposition that a district court judge must find that its initial findings are clearly erroneous before it amends its findings under 5202?
Well, Your Honor, I know that when a successor judge hears a case that does not have testimony, this case did not have testimony, that judge has the same limitations and authority as the original judge. And this court has held that when this court has held that when that a successor judge hears it, the clearly erroneous standard applies to the motion to amend the findings. And that's what this,
you know, I saw that argument in your reply brief, Mr. Westrick. And my question was, isn't it the same judge here in both cases? So what's basis do you rely on to suggest that there was a successor judge here?
Well, no, my argument, Your Honor, is if the authority of a successor judge.
But there isn't a successor judge here.
Correct. But if the authority of a successor judge is the same that the predecessor judge would have had, which is what this court said in the Cook case, and then the successor judge can only change this if it's amended clearly erroneous, then if the two are the same, then the same rule applies. So, you know, 5 + 3 = 8, 8 = 8. And so that's the argument. Since this court has held that the authority is the same, whether they're the successor or the predecessor, when there's been no testimony, it goes. It also seems to undermine that the very rule that allows motions for amended findings that would not apply to the district court when Rule 1 of the Rules of Civil Procedure says very clearly all these rules govern the district courts. And so that's why I believe that the rule of the clearly erroneous standard applies to motions for amended findings. With that, knowing that that's part of my argument, the initial findings weren't clearly erroneous. The findings of the court in its first order go through and discuss that there was testimony supporting them, and the findings were not clearly erroneous. Now, that's a separate issue as to whether or not legally the court's decisions might have been the same, but that's not a motion for amended findings. That's something different. When I started practicing all those years ago, you never brought motion for amended findings after a motion. You only brought them after a hearing that had testimony. because you had the whole difference then between special proceedings and non-special proceedings. And so I often jokingly say to district court judges that asking me to bring a motion for amended findings after a hearing where they've just spent all this time seems kind of like asking, you know, doing the unnecessary act. But the rules require it, and so we all do it now. But I believe that the initial findings, if you read them from the district court, were not clearly erroneous. The bigger point here that I think needs to be discussed is if the district court wasn't going to deny, wasn't going to grant the motion to modify, it didn't need to find what the respondent's income was. But if the district court was going to modify, it needed to say what the income of the respondent actually was, because that's going to go into whether or not the decree has now become unreasonable and unfair. And I'll just use an extreme example. If the respondent was making $1 billion a year, then the $300 amount of maintenance he was paying every month would likely not be unreasonable and unfair.
Where's the statutory obligation of the district court to find a substantial change in gross income of both the obligor and the obligee? Because subdivision 2A1 talks about a finding in the disjunctive, either the obligor or the obligee.
Hold on. Well, that there are cases from this court that say the district court must determine each party's gross income. That's the Phillips case and the Neubauer case. And they say you have to find each because that's part of determining whether or not the finding, the maintenance obligation is both unreasonable and unfair. In other words, we're missing a component about whether it's unreasonable or unfair. Simply a change in circumstance will not warrant the modification of a maintenance order, even a drastic one. And I cited the Kylie case where the person's annual income reduced from $250,000 to $22,000. And this court said, that's not enough. You've got to show that it's unreasonable. You've got to show that it's unfair.
And now, but let's assume that we agree with you that you know, the district court should have made a determination about the respondent's gross income. I'm not quite sure what the harm is here, because I think when I read the findings, the district court assumed that he was able to pay, and then she still concluded that given the other circumstances in the case, that continued spousal maintenance was unjust and unfair.
Well, I agree with you that there was an agreement that the respondent could afford it. But my view is that doesn't necessarily, we need that component to actually determine whether it's unreasonable and unfair. If you have several factors that go in, you need each of the factors in.
But why? Because I think what the district court is saying, if I'm reading the order correctly, is that putting aside the fact that the income is what it is, all of the other surrounding circumstances render the continued maintenance obligation to be unreasonable and unfair.
Well, I continue to assert, I understand exactly where you're coming from, Your Honor, but to me, that is such a big issue because of the fact that we have such a small amount of maintenance here that's being done, that the amount of the actual income earned by the respondent is a critical component in the balancing factor. It has to be, because again, if the respondent were Jeff Bezos making billions of dollars a year, the $300 would likely not be unreasonable and unfair. So
Mr. Westrick, doesn't the case law direct us to look on that determination of unreasonableness or unfairness to the need of the obligee? Isn't that what we're to focus on according to the case law?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that's the focus on when you set maintenance, not when one modifies maintenance. When one modifies maintenance, you're, one, is there a change in circumstances? And two, does those change in circumstances render it unreasonable and unfair, which is a very heavy burden, this court has said in the past. And so that's why I don't think it's just the need, because it has to be both a change in circumstances and an unreasonable and unfair. So it's one factor, and then factor two has two components, just being unreasonable or just being unfair, because it uses the conjunctive, I don't believe does enough. And just very related to that, the next little point I wanted to make is this maintenance is a very, very small amount. This is not $2,000 a month. This is not $1,500 a month. This is a very small amount of maintenance. And I actually question, given the resources that the court did find of the parties, whether or not this would ever be unreasonable and unfair, as almost as a matter of law, given the paltry amount that this is. And I do want to point that out. And that's, again, where the lack of the finding comes in about the respondent's income. Why the court's going to need to, the district court, if the court finds the district court should have made this, it's going to have to come down and go back down for a review. The last point is a point that I just want to make about the fact that when maintenance is given, maintenance has two components. It has an amount and it has a duration. And the district court determined at the time of the divorce that the duration should be permanent, not temporary. And then it set an amount that we're talking about now. And what we are asserting is even if the court said, because of the way things are, he should not be paying maintenance, she should have either set it at zero or reserved it for a future time in case it was necessary, or set it for a dollar. I mean, some kind of nominal thing, $1 a year, so that in the future, if something happened, Ms. Nichols will be able to come back and say, there's been a substantial change in circumstances rendering the order unreasonable and unfair, and I should be allowed to ask for maintenance again because I received permanent maintenance.
And if you make this argument below?
I didn't, because, Your Honor, once the trial court granted the amended findings, we're done. Unfortunately, this issue didn't come up previously because the court originally said, no, I'm not going to modify this. So no, it was not. And incidentally, just so the court knows, I was not counsel before the district court below. I only got this case afterwards. So, but no, this argument was not made below, but this is something that should have been looked at, because the original divorce decree, the duration was permanent, and my client should be able to obtain the protection of that permanency by being told her maintenance obligation is one, because this court has said, and I think everyone knows this, once the maintenance terminates, it can't be reinstated. Those are my arguments. I see I'm out of time, but does the court have any questions before I hit my mute button? All right, then I will turn this over to Mr. Seeloff. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Westrick. Mr. Seeloff, are you ready to proceed?
I believe, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Ronald B. Seeloff, and I am the attorney representing the respondent, former husband, Scott Gerald Nichols. This case arises out of an appeal by the appellant, the former wife, of an amended order, which was filed on March 2, 2020, amending a previous order filed on 10/11/19. The order from which the appellant's appeal was taken, that's the 3220 order, arose from the respondent husband's Rule 52 motion for amended findings of the order that was filed on 10/11/19. The trial court granted the respondent husband's Rule 52 motion and terminated spousal maintenance. Now, within the motion that was filed with the court and served, respondent husband asked the court for, in the alternative, to terminate spousal maintenance or to reserve it pursuant to the statute. When the matter came up for the hearing, and in the memorandum submitted to the trial court, the appellant former wife's attorney opposed the request to have it reserved. And the first time that this issue has ever come up is on appeal, and I think it's been waived. I want to respond, in case I run out of time, that there is no authority for the proposition that the court uses a different standard in setting spousal maintenance in a modification proceeding or in the original setting. I mean, the statute providing for amendment of spousal maintenance kind of incorporates the MnSTAT 518-552. So, it was the same as your honors have observed. It was the same trial court who issued the original order that also issued the amended order. There is no successor judge, and so none of that case law has anything to do with this case. I have had cases on successor judges, and I'm familiar with the case law, but it has nothing to do with any of the issues in this case because there was no successor judge. In a Rule 52 motion, neither the rule nor any case law that I could find establishes any threshold for a Rule 52 motion. You don't have to show that there was an abuse of discretion or that the original order was clearly erroneous. The trial court judge can change its own order in any way it could have done in the first place, and it can do so without a threshold. I have cited numerous cases for that proposition, and there is nothing I found in the appellant's brief that at all supports that proposition. I want to briefly address the, we had filed a cross appeal in the case. It was kind of, I saw it as a contingent cross appeal because when the appellant filed the motion appealing the 3-220 order, it didn't note that the motion that was filed on 11-26-19 by my client was a tolling motion. And what I was concerned about was that if for some reason this case got remanded or something happened other than an affirmance, which we're asking for, that because the tolling motion wasn't referred to, there we would lose jurisdiction of part of the order, of the first 11-26-19 order. Now, I want to just assert this, that the findings of fact in the amended order, that's the order appealed from, are fully supported by the evidence, and the findings of fact and conclusions of law fully support the order that was entered. There was no abuse of discretion. There was no error of law. Appellant advances four arguments, none of which have any merit. And I want to repeat that there is no merit to any of these arguments because there is no case law authority or statute supporting them. The first issue I think has been addressed by the court that there is no threshold or standard for a motion for amended findings. I cited several cases in my brief, pages 12 and 14, that the trial court is not bound by original order and can amend the order essentially in any way it could have in the first place. The Court of Appeals has encouraged motions for amended findings so that the Court of Appeals doesn't have to deal with issues when the trial court can do it themselves. Rule 52 does not require it, nor does any of the case law. The second argument that the finding of the husband's income, the husband respondent's income was required, is clearly erroneous. None of the applicable statutes, that's MnSTAT 518-552, MnSTAT 518A.29, or the statute dealing with cohabitation and marriage, none of them require a specific finding of income. I cited numerous cases in my page 20 to 23 of my brief, including the Kelsenberg case, the Dobrin case, the Neubauer case, the Patarka case, the Grind case, all stand for the same proposition that a trial court does not have to make specific findings on any particular issue as long as it is clear from the record that the trial court considered the factor. Now, the item complained about here is that there was no finding about income, but yet the court very specifically in the 3-2-3-2020 order specifically referred to exhibits L&M, which set forth the husband respondent's income and in effect incorporated that by reference. It's obvious that the court fully considered it. But in addition to that, that the finding of substantial change of circumstances was not based on a change of the husband respondent's income. It was based on the 270% increase in the wife appellant's income. So his income was not part of the substantial change of circumstances. Second, the respondent admitted that he could afford to pay $300. The issue was not before the court. In effect, the issue was moot. And if this court were to remand the case back to district court because of to put that finding in, and because this is a motion for amended findings, not for new trial, where there's new evidence, that the court would then find that what his income was as incorporated already, and there would be no change at all. So it would be a useless act to do so. The third argument that has no merit, it says, the argument is, notwithstanding appellant wife's increase in income, the decree was not rendered unreasonable and unfair. Now, that's the argument made. Well, that might be an appropriate argument to make to the trial court, but that's not the argument made to the Court of Appeals. The argument to the Court of Appeals is that there has to be an abuse of discretion. And the trial court specifically made extensive findings that there was judgment decree was there was a substantial change of circumstances and it was unreasonable and unfair. So the argument essentially fails because the argument is irrelevant. And I call the court's attention to the a specific finding. It's paragraph 30, page 7 of the 3-2-20 order. Including extensive findings where the court says, quote, petitioner is no longer in need of spousal maintenance, and also made a finding that the spousal maintenance should be terminated under the cohabitation statute as well. So there's a double finding. So my point basically is that the evidence supports that because what the trial court found was that in the initial order, the appellant wife had a $70 surplus. That was her expenses over her income, a modest surplus. But after we pointed out in the motion for amended findings that the $500 payment for the adult son to subsidize his rent and the erroneous and I'll say false assertion that she was paying $437.33, double that per month, the court corrected that. And also noted that that the record actually showed that the allegation by the wife that her interest was more than the monthly payment was simply false. And you'll see that in the record. So what happened was that the court found that her surplus went up to $1,007 a month. And in effect, she had no need for spousal maintenance. So the fourth point I want to make is that the claim that it should have been reserved, that's been waived. It wasn't raised until the time of appeal in the 11720 affidavit or memorandum submitted by her then attorney, not Mr. Westrick, said that they were opposed to the entire motion, even though the motion had on the alternative a reservation. I want to also, in that same memorandum, the former attorney said that there was no findings necessary other than what the court made. Now, you can't say that you need a finding of income if the motion is granted, but you don't need a finding of income if it's denied. And any proposition that the findings differ. So in effect that they've waived that as well. So I would ask the court to affirm the in full the trial court's order. This court should find that there was no abuse of discretion because the evidence fully supported the findings of fact, and the findings of fact and evidence supported the conclusions of law. This court should find that there is no requirement that the income of the husband respondent should be specifically found, and that it would be a useless act if it were required. And further, that consistent with the case law, the trial court extensively considered that income and obviously made an express reference to the exhibits which attached to the respondent's affidavit in support of it, and should then also deny the request that spousal maintenance be reserved. Incidentally, the court made a further finding on that reservation issue that in the initial order, the court found that the appellant wife might need some income in case she got divorced or didn't live with her new friend anymore. But with a $1,007 surplus, the court specifically found that that she would not need this income in the future. And so that issue was made too. So I'm concluded.
Thank you. Any questions from either of my colleagues? Seeing none, Mr. Westrick, do you have any rebuttal?
If I may please, Your Honor.
Yes.
Of course, there's a different standard for amending a decree and getting the initial maintenance. Is it unreasonable and unfair? I want to point out that the case that's relied upon by respondent in his brief about the clearly erroneous rule is the McCauley case from 1977. And one has to remember that in 1985, the rules of civil procedure were amended. Rule 52 was amended. And thus this court later held that pre-1985 cases are then of lesser value in determining how the rule should be interpreted. So I want to point out that when everyone says I haven't presented any authority, the earlier authority just doesn't support anymore what people are saying that it is. The husband's income has to be a factor in determining whether the obligation is unfair. And the fact that the motion was objected to and opposed below doesn't mean that somehow this issue has been waived. I think the way Mr. Seeloff described it is wrong. I do agree there's an abuse of discretion aspect to this, but I want to point out that an incorrect application of the law is an abuse of discretion. And so I don't like to guess how trial courts do things on remand. I know Mr. Seeloff has predicted how the court would rule. I'm not so sure, and I don't know whether this court should make that guess either. The finding's either there or it's not, and the court should do this. So at a minimum, we're asking the court to send it back. But we're really asking is for the court to determine that the clearly erroneous standard applied and that the court should not have modified its findings. Unless there's any other questions, I will yield my time. Thank you for your time and attention, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted, and we'll have our decision out within the 90 days. And that concludes our oral calendar. We now are